But at this point, you basically have a lot of the carriers, long distance and data carriers, scrambling to reroute in the shortest time frame.
A strong earthquake knocks out cell and internet service in much of Southeast. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, July 25th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a state Supreme Court ruling in favor of gay rights in Alaska.
We certainly would have welcomed a broader ruling, but I think that the court also knew those rulings are coming, all in due time.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Mother Nature rattled northern Southeast this morning with a magnitude 5.9 earthquake and several dozen aftershocks. The quake appears to have damaged internet and cell service to thousands of Southeast residents. Margaret Friedenauer of KHNS and Haines has more.
Alaska Power and Telephone is one of the primary internet and cell providers for Haines and Skagway and several other small Southeast communities. With 3,000 to 4,000 of its customers without service, spokesman Mark McCrady says the company presumes a major underwater fiber optic cable near Juneau was affected by the quake.
It sounds like the majority of our Southeast Alaska customers are affected because I believe that particular highway was our primary link between Seattle and Alaska to the rest of the world. So at this point, you basically have a lot of the carriers, long-distance and data carriers, scrambling to reroute and talking to each other to determine how best to get that accomplished in the shortest time frame.
The cable is owned by Alaska Communication Systems, but used by several providers, according to AP&T. ACS has not released any details of the outage or an exact cause, except to say it's working to restore service. There was no information from AP&T or ACS about how long the outage might last. The main quake happened just before 3 a.m. and was centered about 40 miles west of Gustavus. That's along the Fairweather Fault, according to state seismologist Michael West of the Alaska Earthquake Information Center. At 5.9 magnitude, it was widely felt, and he said it is considered a significant quake.
Only in Alaska would we dismiss that as maybe not that big. We really have the magnitude scale like completely devalued in Alaska. 5.9 is a very, very significant earthquake.
West also explains earthquakes can generate underwater landslides that can damage or sever underwater cables. He can't confirm that's the exact cause of the Southeast outage, but it's definitely plausible, he says.
There are well-published studies on submarine landslides in this area. You look at Southeast, right, there's big, tall mountains and big glaciers. And what are these processes doing? Well, they're dumping massive amounts of sediment right into the ocean, you know, right offshore. And so that whole area is known to be very prone to landslides. We're speculating here right now, you and I, but there's every reason to think that an earthquake of nearly magnitude 6 would be capable of generating modest submarine landslides.
Reporting from Haines, I'm Margaret Friedenauer.
The Alaska Supreme Court has ruled that same-sex partners are eligible for death benefits, even though they are prohibited from marrying by the state constitution. The case was brought by Deborah Harris, whose partner, Carrie Fadley, was murdered in 2011. Fadley was a manager at the Millennium Hotel in Anchorage and was shot and killed on site by a disgruntled ex-employee. When Harris applied for survivor benefits, she was denied by the Alaska Workers' Compensation Board on the grounds that the couple was not married. Harris appealed the decision, arguing their relationship had spanned more than a decade and that the two would have married if the state allowed it. Lamba legal attorney Peter Wren argued for Harris.
It's pretty humiliating to be told, as you're grieving from the loss of the person that you love most on this earth, that your relationship was essentially worthless and that your family is not the kind worth protecting.
The Alaska Supreme Court sided with Harris on equal protection grounds. The court reasoned that because same-sex partners cannot legally get married, the denial of survivor benefits on that basis would essentially block a whole class of people from ever accessing them. Harris's benefits claim will now be sent back to the Workers' Compensation Commission. This is the second case the court has taken up this year where it has reaffirmed that the marriage ban does not extend to same-sex benefits. The Alaska ban is currently being challenged in federal court with arguments scheduled for October. Sponsors of a marijuana regulation initiative have filed a complaint against their opposition, alleging that Big Marijuana Big Mistake has violated disclosure rules. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
At issue is whether the owners of the anti-marijuana group's public relations firm are serving in a volunteer capacity and whether the firm's time is being properly accounted. Here's Christina Woolston, a majority owner of Northwest Strategies, at an Anchorage Chamber of Commerce debate on Monday.
I'm the volunteer spokesperson for the grassroots organization Big Marijuana, Big Mistake, Vote No on 2.
And later calling out the pro-marijuana group's representative.
You're a paid spokesperson to represent the industry.
The campaign to regulate marijuana like alcohol has a problem with that. They're alleging that Woolston isn't properly disclosing her financial connections to the No on 2 group. Initiative sponsor Chris Rempert filed the complaint on Thursday, and he believes the anti-marijuana group is using that as a tactic to paint the initiative sponsors as outsiders.
It's very clear that they're willfully misrepresenting themselves to the public, to the media, and to election regulators because they think that'll benefit them.
State statute requires initiative campaigns to disclose their expenditures within 10 days, and the Alaska Public Offices Commission requires any sort of commercial services provided by volunteers to be documented as campaign contributions. Northwest Strategies started working for Big Marijuana, Big Mistake in mid-April, and the campaign's first independent expenditure report was filed about a month and a half later. None of the campaign's reports make any note of Woolston's volunteer time. Woolston believes that the APOC complaint is a distraction and that initiative sponsors are using it to divert attention from the $500,000 in funding they've received from the D.C.-based Marijuana Policy Project. Woolston says she identifies herself as a volunteer because she is not a salaried employee of Northwest Strategies.
Yeah, well, this isn't my job. I mean, the work that I do is volunteer. You know, I don't work at Northwest Strategies. I work for Chinica Corporation. I understand the ownership issue, but it's a family business. And, you know, it's really they're grasping here.
The connection between Big Marijuana, Big Mistake, Northwest Strategies, the Chinica Corporation, and the Woolston family is a bit of a tangle. The Chinica Corporation has given $25,000 to the Big Marijuana, Big Mistake campaign, and Woolston is an executive there. Big Marijuana, Big Mistake is also a client of Northwest Strategies, which Woolston and her husband own. According to expenditure reports, Northwest Strategies has done nearly $25,000 in work for the campaign. Woolston says that when she identifies herself as a volunteer, she's representing herself as a Chinica Corporation executive, not as an owner of Northwest Strategies. She adds that Northwest Strategies has a $7,500 a month contract with Big Marijuana, Big Mistake, but the amount covers hard costs only, and she is not personally profiting from it.
My husband and I both volunteer our time. Yes, we do have an agency that has a very small contract, really a drop in the bucket if you want to talk about numbers and what the opposition is being paid.
But the campaign to regulate marijuana like alcohol takes issue with that logic. Taylor Bickford is a spokesperson employed by the Pro Initiative campaign.
You can't say you're giving something away for free and then charge for it.
Woolston says she still plans to identify herself as a volunteer when campaigning against the marijuana ballot initiative. In Anchorage, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an unusual journey from Singapore to the Ketchikan shipyard.
I mean, my mom didn't really think I lost my mind. Some of my friends did. They were like, what?
Cat, are you serious?
I'm like, yes, I am. Very serious.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you've served in the military, the Alaska VA welcomes you home and thanks you for your service. Enroll now for health care benefits. Yukon Kuskokwim Village veterans can enroll at the Veterans Stand Down event at Bethel August 1st through 3rd at the Old Armory Killbuck Gym. Learn about VA, state, and community programs, meet with staff, enjoy a free meal, and receive free military surplus gear. Apply early at 543-6705. This message sponsored by the VA.
A federal agency is testing the waters on a possible new lease sale in Alaska's Arctic. The U.S. Bureau of Ocean Energy Management plans to take comments on areas in the Beaufort Sea that have the most promising oil and gas potential. The agency says it also wants to learn more about environmentally sensitive habitats and subsistence activities within the planning area. Spokesman John Callahan says this is the first step in a long process and no decision has been made on whether to go ahead with a lease sale. The executive director of the Alaska Wilderness League says her group does not want to see more drilling in the Beaufort, citing the uncertainty of the Arctic climate and the lack of scientific information about the Arctic Ocean. A report released today by the World Wildlife Fund in Canada finds the capacity for oil spill response in the Beaufort Sea is woefully inadequate, even as Canadian regulators consider relaxing safety standards for offshore exploration. The World Wildlife Fund ran 22 separate models looking at how different spill scenarios would impact wildlife and habitat in the Beaufort Sea, drawing on industry development proposals and environmental data. Though conducted in Canada, the research affects Alaska as well.
I think that the report is very applicable because, again, it shows that oil spills don't stop at a boundary.
Margaret Williams is the managing director of World Wildlife Fund's Arctic program in the U.S. She says the report demonstrates that subsistence users in Alaska's coastal areas would be hurt if contaminants leaked into the Beaufort's marine mammal habitat.
Almost all of the scenarios show oil moving in a westerly direction from the Canadian Beaufort Sea into the Alaskan Beaufort Sea. We share so many species. We share a common concern about the food they provide to people living on the Beaufort Sea shore.
The report comes as Canada's National Energy Board is about to conclude a public comment period over a proposal to ease its standards for oil spill contingencies in offshore operations. After a summer of long Chinook salmon closures and a weak chum run on the Kuskokwim River, middle and upper river subsistence fishermen eagerly await word about whether the federal government will take control of the fishery. KYUK's Ben Matheson reports.
The Office of Subsistence Management in Anchorage is preparing to present the Federal Subsistence Board with information and a recommendation on whether to federalize the salmon fishery, which is currently under state control. Evelyn Thomas is the Tribal Council President in Crooked Creek, a community of about 100 people located 120 miles upriver from Bethel. She says her tribal council plans to pass a resolution in support of federalization. She says the state has not listened.
They keep wanting to have openings for silvers and late chum run when we haven't even gotten enough to put up. The subsistence users don't have fish yet. I know here in Crooked Creek, nobody has enough.
Gene Peltola Jr. is the Assistant Regional Director for the Federal Office of Subsistence Management. They are currently responding to a growing number of resolutions from tribes and groups who want to ensure they get silver salmon. His team is in the early stages of drafting a recommendation based on current and historic data related to silver salmon harvests.
There may not necessarily be an allocation between the federal qualified user aspect of it. So that's the part, one of the parts we're reviewing now, is that we may not necessarily have a full 804 determination or analysis.
That refers to Section 804 of the Alaska National Interest Land Conservation Act, or ANILCA, which determines how to distribute a resource that isn't abundant enough for all subsistence users. The Federal Subsistence Board has a work session next week. Peltola Jr. says he doubts they'll take up the issue at that meeting, and it could take more time to issue a decision. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Usabelli Coal has submitted a plan to drill coal bed methane exploration wells on state land near Healy. The company can look for shallow gas on more than 200,000 acres of state and private land, KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The exploration plan submitted for state approval calls for fewer than five coal bed methane wells on a small pad within Usabelli's existing coal mining operation. It's about 7 miles east of Healy. Usabelli spokeswoman Lorelei Simon says the site makes a good first target.
It has good geology and established access from prior coal exploration and mining activity as well. And it's underlain by one of our largest coal seams.
Simon says if the resource proves up, the company may pursue approvals necessary to develop it and help power the mine's operation.
Reduce some of the demand that Usabelli currently puts on the intertie and getting power from Golden Valley Electric.
If there's a lot of gas, Simon says Usabelli could consider commercial sale to offsite users.
We'll certainly take a look at it. I mean, if we do find significant reserves up there, we would look into additional permitting and feasibility and next steps to see what we could do to help get that gas to market.
The company's Healy Area Exploration License borders on Denali National Park and was contested by some area residents led by the Denali Citizens Council. The group successfully fought for tighter regulations on and near private property, but failed in efforts to exclude some residential areas and wildlife habitat, primarily lands west of the Nenana River and Parks Highway. The proposed coal bed methane exploration plan is focused east of the river and 3 to 4 miles from residential areas, but Denali Citizens Council issues President Hannah Ragland says the group is still tracking it.
Because we're wanting to make sure that we are on top of this process of permitting, and also because what happens with permitting here will likely apply to the process if drilling exploration happened on the west side of the river.
Ragland says broader concerns about waste disposal and noise are minimized in the proposed exploration because it's within the mine site. The plan calls for drilling muds to be disposed of at Usabelli's own landfill, with any petroleum-tainted mud trucked out for incineration. The drilling operations could use up to 20,000 gallons of water per day from nearby creeks, a well, and pond. Production water, which can contain gas and toxins, would be re-injected into the coal bed methane wells. Ragland says the DCC plans to comment on some aspects of the development plan, including water usage.
One thing I did notice in the mitigation measures was that Usabelli is suggesting that a plan for monitoring noise and water quality and quantity is not applicable because it's on lands that are currently being mined for coal. So somehow suggesting that because it's at an existing coal mine, water quality and quantity doesn't matter. And I guess I would disagree with that statement.
Public input will be considered in review of Usabelli's coal bed methane exploration plan. And Thomas Barrett with the State Division of Oil and Gas says water use and other state and federal permits must be additionally secured.
Our authorization is only one portion. And in the application they have submitted to us, they have outlined several other permits and authorizations that they will require either along the way or before commencing operations.
The state is taking public comment on the exploration plan until August 18th. Barrett says a decision could come within a month and will be followed by a 20-day appeal window. Usabelli hopes to begin exploration work this fall. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Annie Bartholomew. This week on AK, welding. There are more than 100 people employed at Ketchikan's Vigor Industrial Shipyard. Out of all of them, Kat Wong might have the most unusual story about how she got there. The 25-year-old is a pipe fitter and welder. She was born in the U.S., but grew up with her family in Singapore. When she was 21, Kat made an unusual choice and ended up in Ketchikan. KRBD's Emily Files has more.
That's a 3-inch pipe, and that would be like a 3-inch flange that I'm welding on there. It's going to be a water main pipe.
Kat Wong is welding a pipe for an Alaska Marine Highway ferry.
She's 5'2", and her thick work jacket and boots look like they were made for someone twice her size. Kat says back when she was 18, she never would have guessed she'd end up here. She was working two part-time jobs at a bar and a restaurant in Singapore, hoping to become a restaurant manager.
And I just got to the point that I needed a full-time job because I was working long hours as a part-timer. So I just sent out my resumes to, you know, whatever companies that would hire me. And a company hired me in Singapore, and that was an industrial training center for construction workers. And I was the admin assistant.
Kat hated sitting at a desk all day, but that job was actually what put her on the path to shipyard work. She started to get interested in skilled labor, like welding and maritime trades. The more research she did, the more interested she became.
My mom wasn't too sure about it. You know, it's like, oh, your office worker daughter is gonna wants to work in the shipyard, wants to learn welding. You know, they thought I like went off the cliff or something. They thought I lost my mind. I mean, my mom didn't really think I lost my mind. Some of my friends did. They were like, what? Are you serious? Kat, are you serious? I'm like, yes, I am. Very serious.
Kat decided to sign up for a welding class, but the industrial training center where she worked wouldn't take her.
Liability issues, they were afraid I would get hurt.
Why?
I don't know, they... Women, welding, fragile.
So she went to a different center, and they were hesitant to train a 20-year-old woman as well.
How'd that make you feel?
More determined. I was like, here's the money, do you want it or not?
They took Kat's money and she took the welding class. After that, she tried to apply to skilled labor jobs in Singapore, but realized the chances for a good-paying gig were slim. But she had another option. Because she was born in the U.S., Kat was an American citizen. In Singapore, you're not allowed to hold dual citizenship. But Kat could choose to give up her Singapore citizenship and move to the U.S. She gradually realized that was her best option. So, a month after her 21st birthday, she went to the immigration office and handed over her Singapore passport.
Yeah, it was sad. And then I realized that if you keep staying in your comfort zone, you know, you don't know what you're capable of.
And then the U.S. job search. With the help of Google, Kat decided the Ketchikan shipyard looked promising. And she realized the only way she would get hired is if she went there in person. So she left Singapore and moved to Alaska, her future riding on the hope of a job at the shipyard. She arrived in late October 2011, on a day the wind whipped the rain sideways. After she settled in, Kat started showing up to the shipyard.
But it was like just a daily process of coming here every morning, writing my name in a logbook, just to show that I'm here.
She applied for jobs and signed up for an advanced welding class at the University of Alaska Southeast. And then, about 2 months later, she got a call from Troy Tacker, a shipyard supervisor.
And then I got a call from Troy asking, are you interested in an interview? I'm like, yes! When do you want me to come in? Tomorrow?
It was very interesting. She's a super intelligent young lady, and she was just looking for somebody to give her a chance. All she wanted to do is work in a shipyard, so I thought, why not?
Now Kat has been there for 2.5 years, learning nearly every aspect of ship repair. She's paid $20 an hour. Over a year ago, her mother and brother moved to Ketchikan from Singapore, and her brother, Felix, also works at the shipyard. So, in a matter of about 5 years, Kat went from a bartender and office assistant in Singapore to a pipe welder in Alaska.
Do you ever feel like, how did I even end up here?
I do feel that sometimes, and then again, it's like, because I'm a church goer and I have faith, you know, in God, and I'm like, my mom and I, we did some praying on it, you know, and we kind of felt the prompting that I have to leave my comfort zone to see how, you know, God would pull you through.
Kat says her story shows that if you put one foot in front of the other, eventually you'll climb a mountain. Or in this case, end up in an Alaska shipyard. In Ketchikan, I'm Emily Files.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading to Thorn Bay on Prince of Wales Island.
My name is Rochelle Huddleston-Lorton. I am the district ranger for the U.S. Forest Service here in Thorn Bay. We're part of an island archipelago in southeast Alaska. Prince of Wales Island is made up of one large island, and then there are a number of smaller islands within the Prince of Wales archipelago. So we're surrounded by water, and in general, the island is accessible by ferry or by float plane. There are a couple of fixed wing opportunities on the west side of the island at Craig. There's about 450 people in Thorn Bay and the area around Thorn Bay, and that includes the city proper, as we call it, and then people on the south side of the bay. There's a little community over there as well that's part of Thorn Bay. It's very remote, very rural. There's no Walmart, there's no Fred Meyer. You know, a lot of things we order or come in on the barge. We've got a great little grocery store here in Thorn Bay that does a really good job of stocking a huge variety of items considering how small it is. There's a lot to do in Thorn Bay. I mean, certainly it is a recreation mecca if you are into the outdoors. There's kayaking. Of course, there's lots of fishing, both ocean fishing and river fishing. Lots and lots of rivers on Prince of Wales. We've got, coho, sockeye, pink salmon runs that come through the island via the rivers. We've got excellent halibut fishing in the salt waters, as well as king salmon fishing. Deer hunting is pretty good here. Hiking, biking. People are very friendly in Thorn Bay. They're willing to share their experiences in terms of great places to go fishing or where they, you know, got that big deer last year. My husband and I moved here about 17 months ago, and people have welcomed us, and I don't feel like an outsider at all. It's been a very pleasant transition for us.
Rochelle Huddleston-Lorton is the district ranger for the U.S. Forest Service in Thorn Bay. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community featured, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Emily Files, Sean Carpenter, Annie Fite, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Annie Bartholomew.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We are online at alaskapublic.org and on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Ben Matheson in Bethel, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Raven Alaska, navigating Alaska's challenging terrain, serving more than 100 communities statewide. Details at raven.com. Raven Alaska, soaring above. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.